Hello, and welcome to Adventures in Anthropology. My name is Jennifer Pawson, and from Wellesley College, I bring you the fifth in five installments on the culture of secrecy. This podcast will be focusing on national secrecy and cryptology. In the previous podcast, I mentioned that in order to conduct fieldwork in this study, I visited Washington, D.C., and traveled to the International Spy Museum. While in the area, I also chose to visit the National Cryptologic Museum, which is located in Fort Meade, Maryland, which is near the National Security Agency. The building itself is located within a quarter mile of the National Security Agency, or NSA, campus. And when you first drive to the museum, it is really off-putting, since you turn right before a guard, presumably there to prevent outsiders from entering the NSA. However, the museum itself, though small, is very easy to look through, and there are guided tours that are also available. In short, I learned about the Enigma machine, which was used during World War II by the Axis forces to encode messages, how slaves passed along coded messages through blankets, and the many ways in which codes have been used and have developed throughout history. But the most striking piece of information I acquired from this trip was that cryptology has existed for quite some time. In fact, one of the most famous examples of codes was used by Julius Caesar to encrypt messages for his generals, and is still called the Caesar Shift Cipher. In this code, one shifts the letters over by a certain number. For instance, if the number is 3, then if there is an A in the message you want to send, it becomes a D in the code. If there is a B in the message, it becomes an E, and so on. All the generals needed to know in order to understand the message was the number of letters that the shift called for. Of course, opposing armies and spies worked on breaking this code, and by trial and error, one sees that you would only have to try 26 combinations. This could take a long time for a person, but for a computer, this code would be broken in minutes. So as technology developed, codes also developed to try to prevent code breakers from learning coded data. However, in this day and age, we might ask, so how does this affect me? Well, cryptology today affects our daily lives, whether we are aware of it or not. The president and other world leaders receive information through encryption, which is then filtered down through the media, so that we might learn about world events. Spies continue to live in and around us, and their messages are encrypted in order to protect the messages from prying or simply observant eyes. But if you use a computer on a daily basis, you are working with cryptology with every movement you make. As you write that paper for English, or as you type up the outline for a meeting, your keystrokes are recorded as zeros and ones, meaningless to most humans. And from there, those numbers might be hidden even further behind passwords or networks. The most common form of encryption that we encounter daily is on the internet. The next time you're near your internet browser, look for that lock symbol that occurs on most shopping websites or email servers, or go to the internet browser's link for your privacy options. You might see a tab for security, and usually in that tab, you find the word encryption. That's right. When you send information over the internet, it is quite often encrypted, particularly your credit card information when shopping. The encryptions, or code, used to protect your information changes slightly depending on the computer you're using and the website you're looking at. However, one of the most frequent and popular codes is called RSA encryption. The RSA encryption is an algorithm or a computer program that takes the information, such as your credit card number, and changes it into a coded message. There are two forms of encryption, symmetric key encryption and asymmetric key encryption. Recall that the Caesar cipher required that all generals receive a message beforehand that said how many letters to change, and then they received the coded message later. This is a great example of a symmetric key cipher. The key to the code is kept very secret, so that the person who receives the message has to know the key before they can break it and before they can respond back in code. This method of encryption takes longer because it takes more time to find ways to get the key to the recipient and then send the code. The asymmetrical key, however, has two different keys, a public key and a private key. As would be assumed, the private key is kept more secret than the public key. In order to decipher or break the code used, the person has to know both the public key and the private key. A good way of describing this is as the Encyclopedia Americana described it. Quote, suppose that an English-German dictionary is put on the public table, but somebody, let's say Wendy Wellesley, keeps the German-English dictionary to themselves, end quote. Then anyone can pick up the English-German dictionary and write a coded message to Wendy, but only Wendy knows how to decipher that message back to English. The would-be solver would have to go through the English-German dictionary word by word to put the message back into English. Of course, the actual encryption that's used by our computers today is a little harder. But now that we understand the basic concept of asymmetric versus symmetric keys, we'll try to understand how RSA 128-bit encryption works and what it means. So think back to the last time you or someone you know bought something online. They probably typed in a credit card number, and presto, the purchase was charged to the credit card. And maybe you thought, well, why doesn't somebody just come along and steal my information? This is where RSA encryption comes in. Imagine a Sudoku grid of 4x4 boxes with one digit of your credit card number in each box. From there, the computer shuffles around the numbers so that the numbers are no longer in their original order. Then, the 128-bit encryption refers to the size of a key used to change the numbers in the grid to a new number. Remember that in current technology, there are two keys, a public key and a private key. The private key is usually the product of two prime numbers, and by product I mean two numbers multiplied together. So a small example of this would be 5 times 7, or 35. Of course, 35 would be a pretty easy number to break because many people know that 5 times 7 is 35. So cryptologists use prime numbers that are hundreds, even thousands of digits long. Then the resulting number would be huge, and the larger the product of the two primes, the larger the key size is. The reason information becomes safe to transmit at 128-bit encryption is because it is nearly impossible to determine the prime factors that make up huge numbers, and very large prime numbers are hard to find. We don't know how often primes will occur or when something will in fact be prime. So in order to find those two primes that made up the key, you have to check every number until you'd find a number that divides it. The RSA laboratories challenge scientists and teams of scientists to factor these very large numbers. The most recent challenge involving the product of a 98-digit prime and a 99-digit prime took a team of 5 scientists and their computer program over 5 months to discover the primes. The fact that encryption actually uses multiple keys to encrypt data implies that it will take people several months or even years to discover the data that is being encrypted. Though the NSA does not consider 128-bit encryption sufficient for data that is classified beyond secret, for day-to-day transmissions of information, one can see that this tends to be the most productive of all encryption formats. In national secrecy, there are also other forms of secrecy to be studied, aside from the actual coding of information. In order to do this, I researched how presidents and other high-ranking government officials have kept secrets, and how those secrets affect a person who is part of that nation or is a constituent of those officials. There are two major themes that arise when studying national secrecy or governmental secrecy. One is that those in power abuse their sanctioned ability to conceal information. And the second is that secrecy has gotten so out of hand that those in power simply mark things as being confidential, despite the fact that the information is not necessarily vital to national security. The first view is espoused in the book Presidential Secrecy in the Law by Robert M. Polito and William G. Weaver. In this book, they discuss how secrecy, quote, imposes tremendous cost on elective government, end quote, and, quote, is capable of destroying or undermining the legal, political, and cultural traditions of our political system, end quote. They also note, however, at the end of the book, that while secrecy may be destructive, perhaps tearing down the freedom that our nation was based upon, secrecy can also be legitimized, and that secrets exist and are necessary. In fact, Polito and Weaver state, quote, legitimate secrets require accommodation into democratic process, end quote. Here I added the emphasis. Thus, those excessive secrecy may pull the entire nation into a culture where openness is scorned and calls for transparency are scrutinized. Secrecy is still required to have a functioning democracy. This conclusion by the writers continues to support what has been seen from studies of personal secrecy and secret societies, that a group's function is somewhat reliant on the ability to keep secrets from other members. The other theme of governmental secrecy is one that I first encountered when reading Daniel Patrick Moynihan's book, Secrecy, the American Experience. And that is that secrecy in the present government is primarily used to focus the attention of the masses. Basically, it is like when a kid taunts another kid by saying, I know something you don't know. For adults, this is a little more veiled, but is basically why there are so many classifications of data. Classified, top secret, secret, and maybe even more titles that we don't know exist. These classifications help the government sort out how much power to give to each level of government. Quote, Moynihan and Shills both noticed how official secrecy during the Cold War took on the overtones of ritual. That is, a performance intended to demonstrate who was in and who was out. In other words, who should have the power and who should be powerless. End quote. Once again, we see compelling evidence that it is not the secret that harms or has direct effect on a person or government, but the illusion of power. Who has the control of the information? Who has access to the information? In addition, this continual idea that we need to classify as much information as possible has actually led to information becoming less secure. Imagine that you have information you want to hide. At first, you see your biggest threat coming from the encyclopedia, so you take that and hold on to it. Then you notice that there are some history books which reference that information. So you take those too. Then you find books which make reference to those history books, so you have to take those too. And then you would have to find someplace to hide all of these books. And since there are more of them, it's possible that someone finds even just one of those books, maybe even the encyclopedia. That is the essence of the problem that the government is facing, says Moynihan. He says that as we classify more and more data, quote, vital secrets are not adequately protected, end quote. In the introduction is also noted, quote, the mere existence of government secrets would now prove to have the power to change the public's mind about the most controversial political issue of the day, end quote. Once more, we see that it is not inherently the information that secrecy protects that has power, but rather the existence of those secrets. Just as in post-secret, secrets lend governments the ability to create a person's identity and even their future. Allowing certain people to access information has created a hierarchy so hidden that the layers of the hierarchy are not transparent even to those involved, just as was seen in the Knights Templar. So personal secrecy relates quite readily to group secrecy, and group secrecy certainly has impacted national secrecy. But it is not so certain whether personal secrecy created national secrecy created personal secrecy, group secrecy created national secrecy, or whether the three arose of their own separate volition. However, we have now found compelling evidence that secrecy is quite a natural part of government and state, and so we find ourselves with a great amount of data about secrecy and its effects on the different levels of culture. We saw how secrets helped create a personal identity and define relationships in the first two podcasts on post-secret and personal secrecy. In the third podcast, secret societies were revealed to have a long-standing relationship with secrecy, as secrecy helped form a structure within organization, such as the one the Knights Templar used, and how secrets were used to create a sense of community or family amongst members. In the study of espionage throughout the ages, my fieldwork and literary research clearly point towards a long history of secrecy being used during warfare and conflict, and that secrets allow spies to have power over non-spies. Finally, this podcast covered how secrets have been used to change and affect national secrecy. Considering how both psychological studies and studies of secret societies strongly suggest that secrecy helps reduce tension in hierarchical organizations, I disagree that the government should disband all current practices regarding secrecy, as was hinted at in Palito and Weaver's book, Presidential Secrecy and the Law. I do agree, however, that clearly secrecy is not always benign and can in fact cause conflict or disruption within communities if the right to secrecy is abused in any way. What is clear from all of these studies is that secrecy is a hard element to separate from the larger society. The lengthy history of secret societies and espionage also point to the fact that secrecy may be a natural part of humanity. One might even say that secrecy is elemental to forming relationships, maintaining relationships or power, and creating culture. So in conclusion, I feel that the old childhood saying, secrets, secrets are no fun, secrets, secrets hurt someone, might need to be altered. After all, secrets are just part of being human. Best of luck to all of you as you navigate the murky waters of secrets and truth. This has been Jennifer Pawson speaking from Adventures in Anthropology at Wellesley College. If you would like to learn more about the sources used for these podcasts, please click the link below entitled Sources. Thank you for listening. Goodbye. Tschüss.